The primary suspect in Friday's shootings in New Zealand went before a district court judge today charged with murder. 28-year-old Brenton Harrison Tarrant from Australia will enter a plea next month. Mike Bush is the Canterbury Police Commissioner.
He has been remanded to the High Court for the 5th of April. And what charges he faces then will be determined by this investigation.
Tarrant is a self-declared white supremacist. New Zealand's Prime Minister says, as brutal as it was with 49 people killed, it could have been even worse on Friday. More from Reuters correspondent Ed Giles.
New Zealand's Prime Minister, Jacinda Ardern, confirmed on Saturday it was clear that young children had been caught up in the attack, saying the attacker had intended to continue the rampage when he was stopped by police.
None of those apprehended had a criminal history either here or in Australia. And as I said last night, they were not on any watch lists either here or in Australia. Given global indicators around far-right extremism, our intelligence community has been stepping up their investigations in this area.
Among the stories from survivors, one from 48-year-old Abdul Aziz, who says he chased after the gunman.
He tried to get more gun from his car. When he see me, I'm chasing with the gun he set on his car. And I just got that gun and threw on his window like an arrow and blast his window. And he thought I shot him or something. And the guns come back and just he drive off.
Russia says it will not leave unanswered the sanctions that the U.S., Canada, and the European Union have imposed for Russia's 2018 attack on three Ukrainian ships, the annexation of Crimea, and Russian activities in eastern Ukraine. The U.S. Treasury Department said in a statement its sanctions target six Russian individuals and eight entities in response to Russia's aggression in Ukraine. This is VOA News. U.S. President Donald Trump has issued his first veto, overruling Congress, which voted to block Mr. Trump's emergency declaration, which was designed to get funding for his long-promised southern border wall. AP correspondent Sagar Magani has a report.
A day after a dozen Republicans joined in blocking his move to go around Congress and securing border funding, the president fought back.
I will be signing and issuing a formal veto of this reckless resolution.
Surrounded in the Oval Office by law enforcement officials and families of those killed by people in the country illegally, he did sign it after blasting Congress for voting against reality.
It is a tremendous national emergency. It is a tremendous crisis.
Lawmakers had said the president was violating the separation of powers by unilaterally deciding where to spend money. It's unlikely they'll have enough votes to override his veto. Sagar Magani, Washington.
Crash investigators suggest they've uncovered an important clue in the wreckage of the Ethiopian 737 MAX 8 jetliner that went down last Sunday, killing all 157 people aboard. Reuters correspondent Julian Satterwhite has our report.
The horizontal stabilizer is reportedly set in an unusual position, similar to that seen in the wreckage of an Indonesian MAX 8 which crashed last year. The position of the stabilizer could help determine whether the plane was set nose down for a steep dive. All Boeing MAX jets now grounded worldwide because of similarities between the two crashes. Problems with the plane's software suspected in the Indonesian incident. Black boxes from the Ethiopian jet are now being analyzed in France. Initial conclusions expected in a few days. In the meantime, Boeing will keep making its bestseller, but deliveries to airlines are suspended.
That was Julian Satterwhite of Reuters. If you're planning to visit Venice, it will soon cost a bit more. The city will begin charging an entrance fee. Venice Mayor Luigi Brugnaro says the money will help pay for the city's upkeep. Sabina Castelfranco reports for VOA.
City administrators say the maintenance costs of Venice are extremely high compared to other cities. Visitors who stay in hotels for the night are already paying a tax, which is added to their room rate. But later this year, day trippers or tourists who visit Venice for just a few hours will also be subject to a fee.
The fees will range from $3 to $11 U.S. dollars per person. No starting date set. More news at VOA.com. I'm Gene Randall, VOA News.
Good evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you live from the English service of the Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clotty in Washington.
It's not the first time that Barrow has fired anybody, but the manner in which that it was done this time around has made it a lot more interesting, given that he came from the same party with Mr. Dabo and Mr. Sane and Diba. To fire them like this, I think, raises a lot of questions.
The Gambian president, Adama Barrow, fires Vice President Usainu Dabo.
Caution financial institutions and everyone, an agency, to be very careful. And that is, I think, I acted rightly. I didn't give directive as governor, but I advised as the incoming governor of the state so that we do not encourage impunity. And I said that the days of impunity are over.
A Nigerian governor-elect outlines his vision for the state's residents.
The allegations that are put against the Ugandan government are set aside, then, you know, there can be normalcy between the two countries. There seems to be some kind of arrogance and unwillingness for either head of state to talk to the other.
And a Ugandan main opposition leader calls on the government in Kampala and Kigali to exercise restraint over frosty relations between the two East African countries. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. The Gambian president, Adama Barrow, has fired his vice president, Usainu Dabo, and two other cabinet ministers. Dabo has been replaced by health minister, Dr. Aissatou Touré. The cabinet reshuffle was made on Friday. No reason was given for the firings. For VOA partner, Derimbai has more from North Carolina.
The firing of Vice President Usainu Dabo followed weeks of speculations about an imminent cabinet reshuffle to be made by President Adama Barrow. The relationship between Barrow and Dabo hasn't been cordial in recent months. The duo had been throwing shades at each other during public functions and political rallies. Dabo is the leader of the United Democratic Party. His party forms the majority in the National Assembly. He was fired together with two officials of his party, Trade Minister Amadou Sane and Agriculture Minister Lamin Damudiba. Pa Samba Jau is a Gambian political activist.
It is not the first time that Barrow has fired anybody, but the manner in which that it was done this time around has made it a lot more interesting, given that he came from the same party with Mr. Dabo and Mr. Sane and Diba. To fire them like this, I think, raises a lot of questions.
The United Democratic Party, UDP, has accused President Adama Barrow of using his presidency to consolidate himself into power. For example, they said Barrow has created a national youth movement with the view of building a political base. He has also been accused of firing UDP officials who are critical of his administration. A case in point is the revocation of the nomination of Yakuba Jaite, a member of the National Assembly. The matter is now before the Supreme Court, where Jaite is asking the court to declare the president's decision unconstitutional. The Supreme Court on Friday has ruled against a request made by lawyers representing the fired nominated member of parliament, Kumba Jaite, who had asked the court to prevent the National Assembly from approving the nomination of Fode Gassama as an MP. This followed President Barrow's decision to revoke Ms. Jaite's nomination, Pa Samba Jau again.
The UDP has the largest number of seats in the National Assembly. They have 31 seats. So are we going to have, for the first time in the history of our politics, where you have more opposition seats in the National Assembly than government supporting seats? So the ramifications, we may not know what they are, but I think it is significant given all the interesting intricacies.
There has been a cold war between Barrow's team and that of the United Democratic Party. UDP MPs in Parliament have been opposing some of the bills coming from the Barrow government. A supplementary budget that was tabled before the new year was rejected by the MPs. Finance Minister Mamburu Ndiaye had to come back to Parliament for the second time before he was able to get the approval of the MPs. Dr. Lamin Conte is a professor of accounting based in the United States.
I think what UDP needs to do is to regroup, and hopefully, you know, they can come and counter Barrow. I think Barrow really has now got the momentum to decide what he wants to do by dividing UDP.
The spokesman of the United Democratic Party, Almami Funding Tal, was contacted for comment by the VOA, but he said he cannot make comments at this time. He says he needed time until his party meets later over the weekend. The State House said the president acted on powers conferred on him by the Constitution to fire Vice President Dabo and the two other ministers. For VOA Africa, this is pandering by reporting.
Meanwhile, the firing of the Gambian Vice President Useinu Dabo and two other cabinet ministers is generating debate. Some say the president might not have the power to fire the vice president, unlike the other cabinet ministers. To address the legal argument about the firing of the vice president, I read Saliu Tal, president of the Gambian Bar Association.
Well, the only thing I can tell you is that that's news I heard, that I saw the press release, and I think that was a political decision, and I would rather not comment on that. But it is something I think he has the power to do under the Constitution.
Looking at the Constitution as it stands now, the Gambian Constitution, does the president have the constitutional backing to fire his vice?
Yes, he does. He does have the legal power to fire the vice president and the ministers. I don't think that is in contention with the Gambia.
So does that mean that the Gambian Constitution or Gambia law is different from other West Africans where the vice president and the president run on the same ticket?
They run on the same ticket. The vice president and the ministers are appointed by the president, and he has the power under the constitution to actually dismiss them.
So what's next that he can do per what the law allows?
Well, as far as the law is concerned, the president is entitled to exercise his legal powers, dismiss any member of cabinet. And that is where the law, as far as I can speak on the law, as to the politics of it, I have no idea what is next. I think I would ask you to ask the politicians.
So what is the stance of the Gambian Bar Association on this development, although political? People, I'm sure, have been asking you to get your opinion as the president of the Gambian Law Association about this development.
Well, we don't have any stance on this. I can speak about I can speak about the law, but we are concerned about acts which are not constitutional or unlawful. In this case, I don't think we really have a stance on this. Our members can have their individual respective stance on this matter. But from a constitutional law point of view, we don't really have a stance on this.
So what will you tell the people of the Gambia who might be a little confused about the political situation now, whether it is legal or illegal, the action of the president?
Well, the action of the president is certainly illegal. He's entitled, he had the power to appoint the cabinet ministers and now has decided to rid them of their positions. That is what he's acting within his powers. And he's entitled to do that. I mean, in terms of the political ramification, that's a different story, but legally he has the power to do that.
Saliu Tal is the president of the Gambian Bar Association. He spoke with me from the capital, Banjul. The Nigerian governor-elect of Imo State has called on religious leaders, labor groups, and residents to help support planned efforts to rebuild the state at a meeting with religious leaders at his home in Owerri. Chief Emeka Ihedioha cautioned officials of the outgoing government to ensure their actions do not undermine the financial strength of the state. But outgoing Governor Rochas Okoracha warned the governor-elect has no constitutional powers to issue directives to banks when he has yet to be officially sworn in. The new governor is scheduled to be sworn in on May 29. For more about his vision for the state, I reach Imo State incoming governor, Chief Emeka Ihedioha.
I envisage to position the state, to reunite the state, to rebuild the state, to refocus the state, and then once again get the state linked to the national, political, and economic grid. Over the past 8 years, we have witnessed a tremendous infrastructural and institutional decay. It's a responsibility that I will undertake to give a sense of belonging and a sense of direction to Imo and our people.
What specific measures do you plan on implementing after you officially sworn in on May 29th to improve the living conditions of residents and the people of Imo State?
Well, in our good governance program, we'll run a transparent administration, seeking and getting input from different stakeholders within the state, and in the process, ensuring that the will of the people wins, we will endeavor as much as possible to put together a comprehensive assembly of Imo elites into the transition team to design a roadmap, working with original documents of our manifesto, and see how that fits into the realities on ground. So we'll design a program that is implementable and taking into cognizance the infrastructural and institutional development programs we have, and the re-establishment of good governance, rule of law in our system. Great emphasis on job and wealth creation.
Governor, you spoke about the will of the people being established. What should the people expect from you?
They should expect a transparent and open government from me, and responsible administration that will restore the practice of democracy as government of the people, for the people, and by the people. And most importantly, respect the operations of the different arms and levels of government.
Talking about transparency, we witnessed some of the challenges that Imo State had with regards to the elections. What are your views?
Well, there were obviously security challenges, but I commend the Electoral Commission for setting out to do a good job. The Electoral Commission did a wonderful job in Imo State. I must commend them. Security agencies did their best. Unfortunately, certain elements tried to undermine the security of the state. But by the grace of God, when I eventually take over as governor of the state, I will reposition us and ensure that security of life and property becomes a fundamental responsibility that government would undertake.
Well, Governor, will there be an independent investigation to ensure the masterminds who sought to destabilize the state are dealt with according to law?
I won't talk about that right now.
Your soon-to-be ex-governor has said that you seem to be in a haste and you are issuing out directives which are illegal to banks in Imo State. How do you respond to that?
In the course of my address to the people of the state, I cautioned, and I'm sure you know everybody cautions. I cautioned financial institutions and everyone, an agency, to be very careful. And that is, I think I acted rightly. I didn't give directive as governor, but I advised as the incoming governor of the state so that we do not encourage impunity. And I said that the days of impunity are over. I'm certain I spoke with very measured language and sense of responsibility. I'm sure he understands it. And if he doesn't, I'm sure he heard it, so he would appreciate it.
What is your message to the people of Imo who will be listening to you and around the world?
They heard what I said in my course of my statement yesterday, and I don't need to reemphasize it. I will come with a sense of responsibility to governance, and Imo will not be the same again. We shall return to the era of purposefulness, transparency in governance, and respect for the rule of law. And we'll ensure that quality reigns again in our.
Chief Emeka Ihedioha is the governor-elect of Imo State. He spoke with me from the Nigerian capital, Abuja. The Ugandan Main Opposition Forum for Democratic Change, or FDC, is calling on the governments in Kampala and Kigali to exercise restraint. The comment followed recent heightened tension between the two neighboring countries. Ugandan Foreign Minister Sam Kutesa was quoted as saying, Rwanda has banned the exportation of goods from Uganda, which he said is an economic war.
However, in a rebuttal, Rwanda said the accusation is a diversionary tactic from the Ugandan government not to address issues often raised by the officials in Rwanda. For more on the call for a peaceful resolution to the tension between the two countries, I reach Patrick Oboi Amuriat, leader of the Ugandan main opposition party, FDC.
For us as a party, we think that the two parties should exercise restraint and that the dialogue is the only way by which an amicable solution to the impasse can be reached. So far, of course, this conflict has sucked the nationalities of the two countries to the extent that people who would ordinarily trade between Rwanda and Uganda can no longer directly trade, and therefore their businesses have been adversely affected.
Sam Kutesa, your foreign minister in Uganda, is saying that Rwanda has placed a tariff, which basically he says is a trade embargo. You attributed this problem as just on pure egos. Why do you say so?
Well, if it were not for that, really, what is the reason for closing the border? I know that there have been counter accusations about each of the two supporting the other's insurgent. If it is not about egos, why should this reach that extent where the leader of Rwanda, as is claimed by Uganda, does not mean well to the leader of Uganda and vice versa? What is happening has been identified. And so really, this calls for humility on the part of either leader, you know, to sit down and have a conversation over what is happening. The allegations that are very clear. I am sure that what President Kagame is saying is backed with evidence, because we've seen evidence here. And really, what is left for our government, the Uganda government, to do is for them to refute that kind of evidence. And I think that if it is refuted, and the allegations that are put against the Ugandan government are set aside, then, you know, there can be normalcy between the two countries. There seems to be some kind of arrogance and unwillingness for either head of state to talk to the other.
Some in East Africa are calling on regional leaders to try to resolve the impasse between Kigali and Kampala. What is your party's position on it, particularly when President Paul Kagame is the head of the East Africa Community and, until recently, the chairperson of the African Union Commission?
As you might know, the East African Community is a small community, and in a way, Burundi is sucked into this conflict because there's already been conflict in the common border between Burundi and Rwanda. What is therefore left of the East African Community heads of state that can probably sit down and begin to offer solutions to this conflict is Kenya, Kenyan President Uhuru Kenyatta, and Tanzanian President Dr. Magufuli. Now, as it turns out, you know, the East African Community, reestablished a few years ago, is still a staggering regional bloc. It is a toothless bulldog that, you know, can hardly bite. And, you know, when you compare this community to the West African Community, ECOWAS, you know, ECOWAS has got the capacity, you know, to rein on a leader and be able to cause a change in mind or a change in a direction, political direction in a country. This has happened in the Gambia, as we all know, and in other countries of West Africa. In East Africa, we do not have that kind of force. For example, we do not have the military might as a regional bloc to influence anything militarily anywhere in the region. And so really, to count on the East African Community that is very small, you know, a few nations that are disjointed, and with Tanzania paying allegiance both to the East African Community and the Southern African bloc COMESA, also even complicates matters more.
Patrick Oboi Amuriat is the leader of the Ugandan main opposition party, FDC. He spoke with me from the capital, Kampala. We'll be right back. The United Nations has held a memorial ceremony commemorating the lives, work, and sacrifice made by the 21 UN staff members who lost their lives when an Ethiopian Airlines plane crashed shortly after takeoff from Addis Ababa to Nairobi Sunday. The UN staff aboard was on its way to attend a major UN environment conference in the Kenyan capital, Nairobi. For VOA, Lisa Schlein has more from Geneva.
Word of the terrorist attack on two mosques in New Zealand came shortly before the ceremony was to begin. In his homage to the UN staff members, the Director General of the United Nations Office in Geneva, Michael Moller, mourned the loss of the victims of that attack, along with all 157 people who died aboard the Ethiopian airplane. After a minute of silence, Muller spoke with sadness, but also pride about the passion, dedication, and expertise of the young professionals and seasoned officials who had lost their lives in the service of others.
There were people like Michael Ryan from the World Food Program, who fought the Ebola outbreak, helped Rohingya refugees, helped in countless other places. And I was touched by what his mother said on Irish television about him. He tried to do the best for others. He was, she said, our hero. And that is, I believe, true for every one of our colleagues. They are all our heroes.
Prisca Chow, who spoke on behalf of the UN staff, called the tragedy one of the most serious to have befallen the United Nations. She spoke through an interpreter.
The 21 staff members who were taken away from us without the time to bid farewell to their loved ones or to their colleagues belonged to 12 specialized agencies and to one peacekeeping mission. Every day, we learn a little more about them and discover what extraordinary women and men they were.
Tragedy has struck the UN family on many occasions. In 2003, a terrorist attack on the UN office in Baghdad claimed the lives of 22 staffers. Another 17 died in an attack in Algiers in 2007. An air crash in the Democratic Republic of Congo in 2011 killed 33 people, many of them UN staff. Chow said it was important to celebrate the lives of these colleagues and to recognize the heavy price some people pay to serve the United Nations and its ideals. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Hello, this is Shaka Sali, host of Straight Talk Africa.
On the next Straight Talk Africa, an exclusive interview with the Vice President of Malawi, Saulos Chilema. The Malayan politician and VOA's Shaka Sali discuss democracy and the upcoming elections. An in-depth look at Malawi's future on the next Straight Talk Africa.
Tune in Wednesdays at 18:30 UTC right here on VOA Africa.
It's the weekend. You deserve something special, and I've got just the thing. A relaxing, exciting, refreshing platter of Pan-African music. That's right, sweeten up your weekend with me, Heather Maxwell, on Music Time in Africa. You'll hear exclusive interviews with Ghanaian Afro-reggae artist Rocky Dawuni and singer-songwriter Ben Soul.
One of the most active and vibrant artists on the scene. Mm-hmm. My collaboration with him was a song called Wickedest Sound.
My Song of the Week features a great song by Voodoo Game, making big waves in Togo right now. And there's so much more awesome music, you don't want to miss it. Stop wasting good time. So sweeten up with me, Music Time in Africa, this Sunday and the following Saturday at 15:05 and 20:05 UTC. Oh yeah!
We'll be right back.
You are listening to Nightline Africa on the English service of The Voice of America. I'm your host, Peter Clote, in Washington, D.C. Coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa, the Saturday music spot from our collection of music from the continent. But first, large crowds turned out in the Algerian capital, Algiers, to protest against the government of ailing President Abdelaziz Bouteflika for the fourth consecutive Friday. Algerian media showed large demonstrations in other towns and cities as well. The country's new prime minister, Nourdine Badawi, is due to announce the members of his team within the next several days. For the UAE, Edward Uranian has more from the Egyptian capital, Cairo.
Thousands of protesters gathered Friday in front of Algiers' historic main post office to press popular demands for a new political regime and the ouster of old guard elements of the ruling Front de Libération Nationale party. Supporters of the protest were calling it a million-man march, although it was clear from numerous videos that crowds had gathered in some areas while others remained empty. Activists complained on Twitter that the government had cut public transportation links to the capital in order to lower the number of participants in the Friday protest. VOA could not independently confirm the claim. Reuters news agency reported that Algerian security forces were blocking roads to parliament and to government headquarters. Incoming Prime Minister Nourdine Bedoui told a press conference Thursday that he would name the members of his new government in the next several days. He says that his new government should be formed by the beginning of the coming week, and the next step will be to organize the National Dialogue Conference the government will oversee. Deputy Prime Minister Ramatan Lamamra told journalists efforts are now underway to organize the national conference under the auspices of veteran UN diplomat Lakhdar Al-Brahimi. He says there have been preliminary discussions to decide the agenda of the conference, and it remains to be determined which parties and sectors of society will be represented. Lakhdar Al-Brahimi told Algerian TV there must be a broad consensus of Algeria's different components before change can be enacted, and that confidence must be built among the opposing actors. He said the process would be slow, but that the journey of 1,000 miles begins with one step. Nourdine Bahboua, who heads the Union of Democratic and Social Forces Party, told Al Hora TV he thinks the government is ignoring the will of the people. He says the people already gave its final verdict, but the regime is ignoring the will of the people by proposing only a partial and temporary plan, even if it may have some good points. Saïd Koudari, a member of parliament and strategist for the ruling FLN party, told Al Hora that critics should wait and see what changes will be enacted before criticizing the new government. He says the new government will be made up of technocrats, and the new prime minister has proven his abilities in government for many years. He says change must take place slowly in order to find a solution to the current crisis. Islamist politician Abdallah Jabballah told a press conference several days ago that the Algerian people must not surrender to the regime or believe its worthless promises. The people must not back down from its legitimate protests, he insisted, until its goals are met. Algerian Army Chief of Staff General Ahmed Gad Salah has warned that unknown elements are trying to pull down the government in a veiled allusion to the Muslim Brotherhood and other Islamist groups. Algeria fought a bitter and bloody civil war in the 1990s after Islamists won a 1992 election that was overturned. Edward Uranian for VOA News, Cairo.
Meanwhile, embattled President Abdelaziz Bouteflika's decision not to seek re-election to extend his 20-year rule installed a new prime minister and a deputy prime minister. He also promised a national conference to include women and the youth. However, critics say the move is a calculated ploy for the ruling National Liberation Front, or FLN, party to cling to power. For the latest development, VOA's French to Africa reporter Raissa Girondon reached Fatah Bendal, a member of the National Council Jil Jadid, an Algerian opposition party.
Algerians said no to the anti regime, so there is no discussion. They want that regime to leave, clearly. As you know, the constitution itself was not respected by the president himself and also by the other institutions like the National Assembly and Senate and the Constitutional Council have no sense up to now to exist because they are all of them are considered as illegitimate from the Algerian people.
So according to you, what's the alternative for the transition?
From Jil Jadid position, the first was that the president, Bouteflika, recognized his incapacity to govern and then stopped his mandate as expected on April 26th. And another committee or this consensual personality will conduct discussion and consultation with political class parties, associations, unions, civil society, and national figures. Those discussions will focus on mainly two topics: build national forum or assembly, and also to form a neutral, non-partisan government.
We didn't hear that much about the opposition party in Algeria. What about the prominent candidate from the opposition?
In the Algerian situation, 1 month before the official election, reasonable to think about one people or one alternative. The more consensual and the more important thing for us is to conduct peaceful transitional period. And then after, every political party have time to present and to debate one clear program within very clear election system.
Fatah Bendali is a prominent member of the Algerian opposition party National Council Jil Jadid. He spoke with VOA's French to Africa reporter Raissa Girondon from the French capital Paris. Meanwhile, Mustafa Tosa, a Middle East political analyst, says it appears President Bouteflika wants to die in office. He adds that for a smooth transfer of power to a new Algerian administration, there's need for the nomination of an independent candidate. He spoke with Raissa Girondon.
In Algeria and abroad, there is a great and solid impression that Bouteflika wants to die in his office in the Zeralda Palace and to have national and international funerals. This is why he is willing to take any step to achieve this goal.
So you believe that he wants to die in power, but according to you, is there another reason that there is no date fixed for the presidential election?
His team wants to be free to impose the timing of the coming events. When new Prime Minister Nourdine Bedoui was asked about that, he answered that the next national conference, which will take place as soon as possible, will have to deal with this big question.
We didn't talk about the presidential party, the FLN. What about the backup plan? Do they have somebody to succeed Abdelaziz Bouteflika?
No. And one of the most surprising things in the Algerian controversial moment is to see that the FLN party, who usually supports the regime as part of the historical legitimacy, taking some distance from Bouteflika and his fifth term. Some of its iconic leaders had made statements very critical toward Bouteflika and his strategy.
Does the resignation of figures close to President Bouteflika announce a crack in the current system?
Yes, I think that the system around Bouteflika is falling down. All the structures that usually support the regime are taking distance. This situation was one of the most decisive factors for Bouteflika and his team to give this false impression he is going away.
What will happen on April 26 when Bouteflika's term expires? On which legal basis the transition will take place?
That's the very big question in Algeria today. Bouteflika decides to extend his term with no constitutional basis. This is why some Algerians begin to qualify it as an illegal term with an illegal president.
How do you think this transition should take place?
The demonstrators are not only asking President Bouteflika to step down, but also they are asking the whole system with his corruption and failure to disappear. in order to calm this crisis, there is no other choice than to nominate an independent personality with credibility and capacity of conviction and seduction. With the help of the army that always plays major role in Algeria politics and with a government of technocrats, he will have the responsibility to organize a real, free and honest presidential race to find democratically a successor to Bouteflika.
Mustafa Tosa is a Middle East political analyst. He spoke with VOA's French to Africa reporter Raissa Girondon from the French capital, Paris. And right now it's time for music from our African collection. You are hearing Otile Brown with Baby Love. It will be followed by Jody and You with Coochie Coochie Oh Baby. And then Jules Santero featuring Ruti and King Bayo with Dear Rabbi. Followed by Makoma with Napesi. And then we top it up with Willie Paul with Msfafi featuring Elani. I Do. Kulinda mpenzi wangu we jiko langu kama mboni ya macho yangu nitakulinda mpenzi wangu achana nao achana nao achana nao nao wenye roho mbaya wanatusema vibaya achana nao achana nao achana nao nao wenye roho mbaya wana tusema vibaya. Baby love, wewe wangu mi wako wa moyo. Oh baby love, sijenecha kwa fitna na maneno yao. Baby love, wewe wangu mi wako wa moyo. Oh baby love, sijenecha kwa fitna na maneno yao.
Smile, you tell me, coochie, coochie, yeah. supernatural. I can hardly live a moment without you, because of you. Oh baby, oh baby, I see me in your eyes. Oh baby, oh baby, I see love in your smile. You tell me clutchy, clutchy, yeah, I understand.
We'll be right back.
is the beautiful thing created by God. He who finds a wife finds a good thing.
Teddy B play Willy Ball and Alain some saxophone. It's our happy day. Sunajua siku kuni leo. Hello, baby. Sunajua siku yetu leo. Hello, baby. Sunajua na kuwa leo. Hello, baby. Kile keki twalikata leo. Hello, baby. Baby, baby. Well, when the sweet pie, sweet pie. Machoma, machoma. Oxygen, yo. Say yes, I do.
Yes, I do.
Baby, baby, yes, I do.
Yes, I do.
Say yes, I do.
Yes, I do.
Baby, baby, yes, I do.
Yes, I do.
Say yes, I do.
Yes, I do.
Baby, baby, yes, I do.
I do. Yes, I, yes, I, yes, I do.
Baby, baby, yes, I do.
Yes, I, yes, I, yes, I do.
Baby, baby, yes, I do. Sito la fetu vile ulikubali mwito wangu.
And that was music from the continent. We hope you enjoyed it. Nightline Africa comes to you on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC from the English service of The Voice of America. And from the rest of the Nightline team, managing editor Shaka Sali, reporter Douglas Mpuga, producer Saida Hamdoun, and our engineer for today, Bill Andrade, we say a big thank you for joining us tonight. And remember, as the elders say, a child does not fear treading on dangerous grounds until he or she gets hurt. I'm your host, Peter Klote in Washington. Good evening, Africa.
This is VOA News. I'm Gene Randall.